Look, it's Monday, March 16th. We're starting the week with the Fed staring down a potential spike in oil and an internal political divide that's starting to look less like a disagreement and more like two different realities. We're also tracking a massive shift in how AI companies are trying to hook you for the long haul. Let's start with the situation in the Middle East. Following up on our look at the region over the weekend, the reporting from the Necessary Conversation suggests we're looking at more than just a feared military conflict. We're looking at a complete breakdown in how American families even process reality. The podcast highlights a family, Bob, Mary Lou, and Haley, who basically serve as a microcosm for the country. Bob supports a potential war with Iran, framing casualties as a metric of success against radical Muslims. His daughter, Haley, sees it as a pointless human catastrophe. But here's the thing. It's not just a disagreement over foreign policy. It's a disagreement over facts. Bob views the government's seizure of election records as a necessary step to uncover fraud, a claim he's convinced is true, despite every investigation saying otherwise. Haley sees those same actions as a direct assault on democracy. It's a shitty situation when you realize that political tribalism has reached a point where empathy and critical thinking are being traded in for ideological purity. When a father and daughter can't agree on whether killing people is going well, the necessary conversation isn't actually happening, it's just two people shouting from different planets. While this debate rages in the abstract for many Americans, it is deeply visceral for the Iranian-American diaspora. This community is currently navigating what's being described as identity vertigo. As reported, they are caught between a desperate hope for regime change in Iran and a paralyzing fear for their families back home. For many, the idea of exile always felt permanent. Now the possibility of an escalated conflict involving the U.S. and Israel has introduced the fear that the regime could actually fall, which sounds like good news until you realize it comes at the cost of potential total destruction. The upcoming Persian New Year, Nowruz, is usually about renewal. This year it's overshadowed by the fact that many in the diaspora don't know if they'll ever be able to visit a recognizable version of their homeland again. Speaking of balance sheets and external shocks, the Federal Reserve is looking at a very ugly one this week. Look, the Fed is meeting, and the vibe has shifted from when are we cutting rates to how bad is this going to get. Here is the situation. According to the projections discussed in our source material, there is a scenario where WTI oil futures could open above $100 a barrel. If that happens, it's a direct hit to the Fed's inflation math. When oil jumps, inflation expectations follow, which makes it incredibly difficult for the Fed to do anything other than sit on their hands. Because of this, the market has basically pulled back on the idea of significant relief this year. The podcast notes that interest rate swaps are now implying only 20 basis points of potential cuts by the end of the year. To put that in perspective, that is a huge drop from what people were betting on just a few weeks ago. While the big shops like Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo are still officially predicting some cuts, they're now admitting that sustained high oil prices are making that a very hard needle to thread. Later this week, the Fed is going to release its summary of economic projections, the dot plot. Keep an eye on that, because it's likely going to signal a move toward a stagflationary environment. That's the shitty scenario where growth stalls out while prices stay high. It's the economic equivalent of being stuck in traffic in a car with no AC. On the corporate side, we have two major indicators. First, Micron Technology is dropping its earnings report. Analysts are expecting strong numbers, but the real story is in the guidance. There is a very real fear that the industry is overinvesting and hitting a cyclical wall. Then you have Meta. Mark Zuckerberg's shop is reportedly looking at another round of substantial layoffs. This isn't just about efficiency in the abstract. It's a direct response to how much they are pouring into artificial intelligence. They are essentially trimming the headcount to pay for the GPUs and the power bills. According to reports, this is a strategic pivot. They're reevaluating their entire cost structure because AI isn't just a feature anymore. It's an incredibly expensive line item that's eating the rest of the company. Now let's pivot to something happening inside our own borders, the treatment of student athletes. There's a systemic culture of emotional abuse in college sports that is finally being dragged into the light. We're talking about persistent verbal attacks, manipulation, and controlling behavior by coaches. And the real kicker? The institutions meant to protect these kids are often the ones shielding the abusers. According to recent reports, universities frequently conduct internal investigations that are essentially perfunctory. They interview the coach, maybe a couple of athletes, and call it a day. Why? Because the NCAA doesn't actually have a specific policy on emotional abuse. They leave it to the schools, and the schools have a massive conflict of interest. They want to protect their reputations and avoid being sued. This allows coaches with documented histories of being absolute nightmares to just hop from one school to the next, leaving a trail of depressed, anxious, and sometimes suicidal athletes in their wake. Take the case of Maria and Marta Galich, as detailed in the source material. Maria went through two mental health crises and can't even look at a basketball anymore. A jury eventually found evidence of emotional abuse and negligence in their case, which is a rare win. But the fact that it took a jury trial to get an acknowledgement of what happened is an indictment of the whole system. The legal system is still incredibly skeptical of mental injuries, making it an uphill battle for anyone trying to hold these programs accountable. Speaking of systems that are rigged against us, let's talk about sugar. Not just as a health hazard, but as a political and economic juggernaut. Historically, sugar wasn't just a treat, it was the engine of African enslavement and European expansion. Today, that power has shifted into a sophisticated lobbying machine. In the 60s and 70s, the sugar industry actually funded research to shift the blame for heart disease away from sugar and onto fat and cholesterol. It's the exact same playbook the tobacco industry used. The news here is the growing backlash against this capitalist food system. People are finally waking up to the distinction between glucose, which the body uses for energy, and fructose, which is mostly processed by the liver and leads to fat production and chronic disease. But look, the industry is still incredibly powerful because they've got deep pockets in states like Florida, and they're playing on a fundamental human craving. Experts are now saying the move isn't to go cold turkey, which usually fails, but to retrain your taste buds and treat sugar as a special indulgence rather than a daily staple. This brings us to Pete Wells, the longtime restaurant critic for the New York Times. After 12 years of eating for a living, he hit a wall, hard. His story is a pretty stark warning about what happens when professional demands override physical limits. He described his life as a dietary casino. He eventually had to walk away from the job to save his health, moving from a life of extreme indulgence to what he calls mindful austerity. He cut out refined sugars and white flour and found that the food noise, that constant nagging urge to eat, actually stopped. It turns out that when you stop treating your body like a trash can for processed goods, your brain actually starts working better. Who would have thought? Finally, let's look at a different kind of getting things done narrative. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro is making a lot of noise by specifically not making noise. In a political landscape defined by performative outrage, Shapiro is leaning into a brand of pragmatic, results-oriented governance. His big talking point is the I-95 reconstruction. Instead of the usual bureaucratic slog, he cut through the red tape and got the highway reopened in record time. Shapiro's whole deal is that government can be nimble if you stop grandstanding. He's moved Pennsylvania's permitting system from the bottom of the pack to one of the fastest in the country. He's also been notably transparent about his own evolution on big issues. He used to support the death penalty. Now he opposes it. He says a conversation with his son and his time as attorney general changed his mind. The second-order implication here is pretty clear. Shapiro is auditioning a blueprint for the Democratic Party. He's betting that voters, even the ones who voted for Trump, care more about whether their schools are good and their roads are fixed than they do about ideological purity tests. He's trying to navigate the minefield of moral clarity on things like anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, without letting the conversation devolve into the kind of tribal warfare we see in the family dynamics I mentioned earlier. It's a gamble, honestly. In a world that seems to reward the loudest, most divisive voices, Shapiro is betting that getting shit done is still a viable political strategy. We'll see if he's right, or if the echo chambers are already too loud to hear him. While politicians try to figure out how to talk to us, AI companies are trying to figure out how to live for us. OpenAI's ChatGPT has shifted its strategy to prioritize long-term user retention over immediate profit. And according to recent reports, it's actually working. The company is seeing what they call a smiling retention curve. Essentially, users aren't just trying the tool and getting bored. They're sticking around for months, discovering new ways to integrate the AI into their daily routines. The goal here is a move away from the reactive chatbot we're used to, the one where you have to type a specific prompt to get anything done, toward what OpenAI calls a super assistant. These are proactive agents designed to anticipate what you need and take action without being asked. The logic is pretty straightforward. Most people aren't great at delegating tasks or writing perfectly engineered prompts. To get to the next billion users, OpenAI is betting that the AI needs to act more like an intuitive operating system and less like a command line terminal, which honestly makes sense. If I have to spend 20 minutes explaining to a bot how to do a 5-minute task, I'm just going to do it myself. OpenAI knows this, which is why they're leaning into agentic capabilities and reasoning models that can handle text, voice, and integrated interfaces all at once. They're also looking at shaking up their pricing, moving beyond the standard subscription model, and even exploring advertising to bring more people into the fold. While OpenAI builds the assistants, the broader AI industry is hitting a massive acceleration point, driven by recursive self-improvement. That's the technical way of saying AI is now being used to build better AI. We're seeing a shift from co-intelligence, where you and the bot work together, to managing AIs. One of the more radical experiments mentioned in the reports involves software factories. These are organizations that rely almost entirely on AI for development and testing. The humans aren't coding anymore. They're just reviewing the final product before it goes out the door. It's a total reimagining of the labor stack. This rapid improvement is causing a lot of market destabilization, which is a polite way of saying things are getting weird and people are losing their jobs. But the reporting suggests we're in a fleeting window where we can still shape this trajectory. Instead of just tracking job losses and feeling helpless, there's a push for actual policy solutions, like taxing AI instead of labor. It's a nice thought, but given how fast these systems are evolving, the window to actually pass those laws feels like it's closing pretty damn fast. On the smaller business side, AI is being framed as the cure for the founder bottleneck. This is the classic trap where an agency owner is the only person who can sell, the only person who can fix problems, and the only person the clients actually trust. If the founder gets sick or takes a vacation, the revenue collapses. The fix, according to founders who've made the jump, is building an AI operating brief. Basically a digital brain containing every success story, strategic principle, and customer data point the company has. By feeding this context into AI models, the bot can start answering questions and making decisions with the founder's voice and logic. We're seeing tools take over SEO discovery, script generation, and video creation, tasks that used to require a whole team or a very tired founder. One example highlighted was Austin Armstrong, who saw his agency struggle because it was too dependent on his personal brand. He pivoted to an AI software model, Syllabi, using automation to handle the heavy lifting. The idea is to move from being an operator to an architect. It sounds great on paper. Use the bots to automate the boring stuff so you can focus on the big picture. But there's a flip side here that we should probably acknowledge. If every agency owner uses AI to automate their services, the barrier to entry drops to zero. When everyone can generate high-quality scripts and SEO plans with a single click, the market gets crowded fast. It's a race to the bottom on price, which means the freedom these tools promise might just turn into a different kind of grind. So we have OpenAI trying to build a proactive brain for your life, software factories building code without humans, and small business owners trying to automate themselves out of their own companies. It's a lot of agency being handed over to the machines in the name of efficiency. Let's just hope we like what they do with it. Efficiency is great for software, but in sports, it's all about the expansion. The National Women's Soccer League is officially in its expansion era. The league is currently in the process of adding its 17th and 18th teams, part of a broader roadmap to hit premier global entity status by 2031. According to the NWSL, this growth isn't just about adding more jerseys to the shop. It's a calculated play to capitalize on a decade of massive soccer events coming to the U.S., starting with the Men's World Cup in 2026 and ending with the Women's World Cup in 2031. To get there, the league is leaning into some pretty aggressive business moves. They've implemented a high-impact player rule, which is specifically designed to keep top-tier talent from fleeing to European leagues by making it financially viable to stay home. They're also pouring money into training facilities and professionalizing the back-office operations of every club. Look, it's about time. For years, women's sports were treated like a charity project or a niche hobby by investors. But these new valuations show people are finally treating it like the massive commercial engine it actually is. The media strategy is where things get a little complicated, though. Right now, NWSL games are scattered across CBS, ESPN, Prime Video, Scripps, and their own streaming service. The league's logic is that being everywhere at once maximizes their reach across different demographics. But honestly, as a fan, trying to find a game shouldn't feel like a scavenger hunt. It's a classic reach versus relevance trade-off. They want the rights fees and the eyeballs, but they're risking making the product a giant pain in the ass to actually watch. There's also a big structural shift on the table. The NWSL is currently analyzing a move to a fall to spring calendar, which would align them with the international schedule and potentially whatever the MLS decides to do. The goal is to ensure players are compensated fairly and that the league is sustainable by the time that 2031 World Cup rolls around. It's a lot of moving parts. They're trying to build the plane while flying it, but at least they finally have the fuel to actually get off the ground. It's about damn time we stopped talking about potential in women's soccer and started talking about the actual balance sheet. It's complicated for the markets, and it's complicated for our internal wiring. Ethan Suplee's recent discussion on the roots of his health journey highlights how childhood food insecurity and shame create lifelong habits. According to a report on his history, Suplee's pattern of secret eating began at age 5, after his grandparents restricted his food and criticized his weight. He also noted that physical activity was framed as a punishment early on, which led to a total rejection of exercise. This early wiring eventually influenced his acting career. He used the actor identity to distract people from his physical appearance and utilized the privacy of trailers to continue eating in secret. It's a reminder that your willpower issues are rarely just about the food. If you were taught at 5 that eating is a crime and moving is a penalty, your brain is going to treat a salad and a treadmill like a prison sentence. It's not a lack of discipline. It's a survival mechanism that's overstayed its welcome. On the productivity front, new retail benchmarking shows that convenience stores are losing massive amounts of money to non-core activities. Specifically, up to 20% of stock replenishment time is wasted on staff just walking around the store. The report found that 60% of replenishment time can be eaten up by taking stock for a walk, bringing items to the floor that don't actually fit on the shelves, and then hauling them back to the stockroom. We do this in our own lives, too. We mistake movement for progress. It's the digital equivalent of taking stock for a walk, shuffling emails and tweaking fonts instead of doing the one thing that actually puts the product on the shelf. Stoic philosophy offers a fix for this: the practice of elimination. Marcus Aurelius famously advised questioning the essentiality of every single action. The idea is that by cutting the superfluous, you double the effectiveness of the tasks that actually matter. According to Stoic principles, abandoning a goal because of a bad start is just a form of arrogance. It assumes you are entitled to a perfect future. Stuff can feel a bit like a gym poster, but the core point is solid. If you're busy but not productive, you're probably just taking your to-do list for a very long, very expensive walk. If you're taking your FPL team for a walk, you might want to watch your step. Fantasy Premier League managers are looking at a messy landscape for Game Week 31, specifically regarding a potential fixture between Manchester City and Crystal Palace. There's been speculation about this game being rescheduled into the GW31 window, but the logistics are essentially a nightmare. Because Palace plays in the Europa Conference League on a Thursday, and the FPL deadline is that Friday, it's highly improbable a decision will be made in time for managers to actually do anything about it. The takeaway here is straightforward. Stop overthinking the what-ifs. You should proceed as if that fixture is staying postponed. If your strategy involves selling City or Palace assets, don't let the slim chance of a rearrangement stop you. It's a classic case of not letting a 1% possibility paralyze your actual team needs. Honestly, banking on the Premier League and UEFA to coordinate a schedule change in a 12-hour window is a level of optimism that usually leads to a red arrow. On the player front, the big conversation is whether it's finally time to sell Erling Haaland. His recent form has been spotty, and his upcoming fixtures are genuinely difficult. If you have a wild card active for game week 32 or 33, selling him now is a viable move. You might lose some team value when you buy him back later for the double game weeks, but the logic is that avoiding a blank and dodging tough fixtures outweighs the price hit. Meanwhile, Anthony Gordon is the name to watch in midfield. He's got the minutes, he's on penalties, and his fixtures are looking green. He fits into almost any chip strategy right now. If you're looking at forwards, João Pedro is currently getting the edge over Ekitike because his minutes look safer and there's a higher chance of a double game week in 33. For a one-week defensive punt, Yoki Gudmundsson is the shout for game week 31 against Burnley, while Newcastle defenders like Malik Thiaw are better long-term holds despite a harder run. We also need to talk about rotation because Liverpool is making everyone's lives difficult. Diogo Jota and Mo Salah were both benched recently, which is a massive reminder that European commitments are starting to cannibalize league minutes. It makes someone like Bruno Fernandes look better purely because he's reliable and actually plays. Look, Manchester United isn't exactly a well-oiled machine, but at least you know Bruno is going to be on the pitch for 90 minutes. The play for game week 31 seems to be strategic patience. If you have two free transfers, the smart move is likely rolling one of them. In a blank game week, your transfers should be used to replace players who aren't playing, rather than making marginal upgrades to guys who are already in the starting 11. It's about keeping your powder dry for the double game weeks later in the season when the title race and European spots are actually decided and the rotation, hopefully, settles down. It might feel boring to sit on your hands, but burning transfers on a maybe is a great way to ruin your season. Before you go, here's the stuff that didn't fit anywhere else. A few other things worth knowing before you head out. First, a look at the business of dead bodies. Historically, the church and the law made it almost impossible for doctors to get their hands on cadavers legally, which basically forced the medical field to rely on grave robbers and black markets. Even now, that legacy of unregulated sourcing still haunts the industry. Because when you turn human remains into a commodity, the ethics tend to get real messy real fast. It's a shitty realization that your anatomy lesson might have started with a shovel and a moonless night. In the world of cinema, there's an award called the Golden Fleece, and no, it's not for Greek mythology. It's given to the best trailer for the worst movie. It's a perfect reminder that Hollywood has perfected the art of the two-minute bait and switch, proving that a great marketing team can polish a total turd into something that looks like an Oscar contender for exactly long enough to get your $15. If you're looking at sports or your fantasy lineup, keep an eye on the comfortable lead. When a team goes into a second leg with a massive advantage, they usually stop trying to score and just park the bus, which actually makes them incredibly vulnerable to a desperate counterattack. It's the classic trap of getting too cozy. Playing not to lose is usually the fastest way to actually lose. And finally, if you want to see how a city really functions, look at the outskirts. we have this habit of pushing all our industrial waste and crumbling infrastructure to the periphery, creating these shadow zones of decay that we just choose not to see. It's a convenient way to ignore the physical cost of our lifestyle, as long as the trash stays just past the city limits, where it's someone else's problem. Anyway, something to think about next time you're driving past a scrapyard. That's the board for Monday. Watch the oil prices, stop taking your to-do list for a walk, and try not to get fooled by a golden fleece trailer.